1972, 5 months after the release of Jimmy Hoffa. Annie Fields, the director's longtime live-in housekeeper, has already poached the eggs, prepared the slice of white toast, and brewed the black coffee Hoover prefers each morning. But she does not hear the sound of a running shower from upstairs or Hoover's footsteps padding around his bedroom. She last saw her boss yesterday when he returned from dinner with FBI Associate Director Clyde Tolson. James Crawford, until recently one of the Bureau's few African-American agents, arrives to do some gardening and oversee household remodeling. Crawford worked as Hoover's driver from 1934 until 1972, when he was forced to retire from the FBI due to ill health. Hoover immediately hired him as a helper. A concerned Annie Fields asks Crawford to tap on the bedroom door to check on the director. It has been a troubling time for the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. Congress recently enacted a law making the FBI leadership subject to Senate approval. Despite the endorsement of current President Richard Nixon, there are cries for the 77-year-old Hoover to resign. Critics cite his abuse of wiretaps, which Hoover has blamed on the late Senator Robert Kennedy, stating that RFK gave his approval for those breaches of the Fourth Amendment. Hoover is also publicly feuding with former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, whom the director is quoted as calling a jellyfish for his flexible code of morality. Hoover's unwillingness to investigate civil rights violations and refusal to prosecute unlawful police conduct have also fanned controversy. In addition, the director is being criticized for placing anti-war activists under criminal investigation, an action that many believe falls beyond the Bureau's purview. Hoover recently made claims that radical elements were attempting to kidnap Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, whom many believe to be an architect of the Vietnam conflict. These charges were proved false, prompting a new round of demands that Hoover retire. And just yesterday, political reporter Jack Anderson published an exposé revealing that the FBI used illegal wiretaps on Dr. Martin Luther King's telephones in order to investigate his sex life. Yet, J. Edgar Hoover hangs on to his job, recently assuring a House Appropriations Subcommittee that he is very much in charge and that the Bureau is prospering. However, there is talk that Hoover will be asked to resign if Richard Nixon wins re-election in 1972. Hoover sees that as yet another storm to be weathered. He is, after all, director for life. James Crawford knocks on Hoover's bedroom door. Hearing nothing, he steps inside. A naked J. Edgar Hoover is slumped on the floor atop an oriental rug. Crawford does not touch the body, with the exception of confirming that the director's hands are ice cold. The cause of death will be listed as hypertensive cardiovascular disease by Washington medical examiner Dr. James Luke. No autopsy will be performed. Footnote: the lack of an autopsy on J. Edgar Hoover, the fact that his remains were embalmed within hours of his death, and his own doctor's admission that the director's heart condition was not serious enough to cause death were extremely unusual and have never been explained by the federal government. End footnote. The news is flashed to FBI offices around the world. Only then is the American public informed of Hoover's death by Acting Attorney General Richard Kleindienst. Congress immediately votes that Hoover's body be allowed to lie in state within the Capitol Rotunda. This honor has been allowed for just 21 persons in American history. President Nixon himself will give Hoover's eulogy at the National Presbyterian Church 2 days from now. From the discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's body to the many public condolences now pouring in, just 3 hours elapse. Yet the urgency of those events hardly compares with the lightning-fast dispatch of J. Edgar Hoover's secret files. Upon discovering the director's lifeless corpse, Agent Crawford instructs housekeeper Annie Fields to call Assistant Director Clyde Tolson, Hoover's confidant and second in command. Tolson then phones Helen Gandy, the director's personal secretary. The 75-year-old, an avid trout fisherman and spinster who has worked 55 years for Hoover, immediately begins the destruction of the official and confidential files. Among the memos that will mysteriously escape the shredding is a teletype from the Los Angeles field office stating that Bobby Kennedy borrowed a white Lincoln Continental convertible from Special Agent William Simon in order to visit Marilyn Monroe on the night she died, potentially placing RFK at the scene of her suicide. To Hoover, these files were not blackmail, but a valuable means of keeping his power. Among the data now being destroyed is the long list of congressmen having ties to organized crime. Hoover has never once leaked this information or sought prosecution of these corrupt politicians. In 1992, 20 years after J. Edgar Hoover's death, Gambino crime family capo Carmine the Doctor Lombardozzi will explain why. J. Edgar was in our pocket. He was no one we ever needed to fear. Footnote. It is alleged that mafia financier Meyer Lansky had been blackmailing Hoover since 1935 over homosexual acts. At the time, Hoover was known to frequent a Havana gay nightclub known as Cocktail while wearing a fake mustache as a disguise. End footnote. Hoover's death brings to an end one era of law enforcement, even as the 1970s usher in a changing time for organized crime. As it has been since the Kefauver hearings 2 decades ago, the secret world of the mob is a source of endless fascination to Americans. The Godfather, a novel loosely based on New York's five families, sells more than 9 million copies and remains on the New York Times bestseller list for 67 weeks. The subsequent film and sequel of the same name make organized crime even more accessible to the general public. Not surprisingly, the mafia tried to shut down filming of The Godfather before it even began. The mob-connected Frank Sinatra sang at a Madison Square Garden fundraiser for the Italian-American Civil Rights League, a group of which crime boss Joe Colombo Sr. is a member. Monies were to be used to battle negative media depictions of Italian-Americans, particularly The Godfather. But eventually, after producer Al Ruddy secretly paid Colombo for the privilege of filming in New York, production was allowed to commence. But Colombo's very public entanglement with The Godfather was heavily frowned upon by other New York crime families. In a vivid instance of art imitating life, on the same day director Francis Ford Coppola films a scene depicting the murder of a mafia boss in New York, actual crime boss Joe Colombo Sr. is shot in the head just 4 blocks away. The hit occurs during the Italian-American League's public rally in Columbus Circle. Footnote. It is alleged that Joseph Crazy Joe Gallo ordered the hit. The mob used an outside individual to do the shooting, an African-American named Jerome A. Johnson, who was immediately killed by Colombo's bodyguards, even though he was already in police custody and surrounded by policemen. Johnson got close to the mobster by posing as a credentialed reporter. Amazingly, Joe Colombo survived the bullet to the head, but was paralyzed for life and had little ability to communicate. End footnote. After the film's release, the mafia is so taken with The Godfather that some mobsters adopt many of the rituals seen on film. The cheek-to-cheek kisses of made men, the act of kissing The Godfather's ring, and even use of the term Godfather, all long ago abandoned by crime families, once again become part of the mafia ritual. The movie wins 3 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. Dangerous and violent men revel in its success. But reality will soon intrude. In January 1975, the Senate Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities begins investigating the inner workings of the FBI and CIA. Led by Senator Frank Church of Idaho, this church committee is soon stunned to discover that they are uncovering some of the most tightly held secrets in America. In addition to learning that the FBI and CIA are opening the mail of average citizens, eavesdropping on their telephone conversations, and even breaking into their homes to gather evidence, the church committee confirms that the CIA actually hired mafia killers to assassinate Fidel Castro. The committee hastily works to put a real-life mafioso on the stand. That man is Sam Giancana. The American public's fascination with the mob leads Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield to warn against turning the hearings into a television extravaganza rather than a serious investigation. But it's too late. Giancana's pending appearance ensures enormous publicity for the proceedings. At Giancana's last appearance before a Senate committee, he famously sparred with Bobby Kennedy, but chose to take the fifth to maintain his code of omerta. But that was long ago. This time, the mobster promises to speak on the record. It has been a decade since Giancana was a force in organized crime. His flashy lifestyle and unwillingness to share the profits of his worldwide casino operations caused a rift between himself and other top crime bosses. In 1966, he endured a short prison sentence for refusing to testify before a grand jury. Immediately upon his release, knowing that another jury subpoena and prison sentence would be forthcoming, he fled to Cuernavaca, Mexico. This would be his home for the next 8 years, a time when he traveled to Asia, Europe, and the Mideast for business and pleasure. But on July 19, 1974, Mexican officials forcibly enter Giancana's home as he sleeps, dragging him from his bed and sending the mobster back to the United States. He soon returns to his home in Oak Park, Illinois, and attempts to ingratiate himself with the outfit. Sam thought nothing had changed, but everything had changed, a mob informant will tell the New York Times. Sam Giancana is expelled from the mob for good because he still refuses to share casino profits. And so he agrees to testify before the church committee. That seals his fate. On the night of June 19, 1975, two police bodyguards mysteriously abandon their post outside Giancana's house. The mobster is not informed. He is entertaining his youngest daughter, Francine, and her husband, Jerome De Palma. There are others in the house as well, but soon they depart. As the evening grows late, Sam Giancana goes up to his bedroom but finds that he cannot sleep. He then walks down the steps to his basement kitchen and prepares a dinner of sausage, peppers, escarole, and chickpeas. It is a meal Sam Giancana never gets the chance to eat. The gunshot to the back of his head comes without warning, killing the mobster instantly. But the murderer is not finished. Sometimes in the world of the mafia, it is not enough to shoot a man dead. A message must be sent. So the killer rolls Giancana onto his back. The .22 caliber pistol equipped with a silencer is placed between his lips and shoved deep into his throat. A bullet into the mouth is the mafia manner of death for those choosing to testify against them. The gunman fires 6 times. Robert Mayhew, the CIA operative who once colluded with Giancana over the Castro assassination, gets the message. The mob knew Sam wouldn't keep his mouth shut, Mayhew will comment, so it silenced him for good. Johnny Roselli also talks too much. On June 24, 1975, just 5 days after the shocking murder of Sam Giancana, the 69-year-old mobster testifies before the church committee. Roselli is rattled by the murder of Giancana and is plotting revenge against a member of the Chicago outfit, Butch Blasi, whom Roselli suspects of assassinating his old friend. "I'd like to cut his fucking balls off and shove them up his ass," Roselli fumes to Jimmy Fratiano, a longtime mob acquaintance. Nevertheless, Johnny Roselli is talking. He has spent time in a federal penitentiary, and finding himself completely unsuited for a life behind bars, Roselli will do whatever it takes to make sure he never returns. If they're going to kill me, they're going to kill me, the mobster says with a fatalistic smirk, referring to the mob. The testimony in Washington will be the first of three appearances before the Church Committee, covering topics ranging from the Fidel Castro assassination attempt to whether or not the mob played a role in the murder of John F. Kennedy. Roselli will reveal the shocking love triangle among Sam Giancana, JFK, and Judith Campbell. The mafia is not happy about that. When you're called before a committee like that, you have to go to your people and ask them what to do, a confidential mob source will tell the New York Times. Roselli not only did not come to us, he went to the committee and shot his mouth off all over the place. Footnote: Judith Campbell's testimony was meant to be secret, but was leaked to the media in December 1975. This marked the first time John F. Kennedy was publicly accused of marital infidelity, and Campbell was pilloried as a liar. It was only months and years later, as more stories of the president's philandering became news, that Campbell was believed. End footnote. So, even before he gives testimony, Roselli's murder is approved by the 26 top crime families in America. In truth, Johnny Roselli has fallen on hard times. He was sentenced to prison for a card-cheating operation. Footnote: peepholes were drilled into the ceiling above the high-stakes poker tables in Beverly Hills, allowing conspirators to see the cards being played. Signals were then sent to those in on the cheating, telling them whether to hold or fold. The FBI eventually was alerted and served search warrants, leading to a 6-month trial and the conviction of Roselli and four other cheaters. End footnote. Since his release, he has been reduced to owning a gift shop at the Frontier Hotel in Las Vegas. But it is too dangerous for Roselli to live in that town, so he resides with his sister and brother-in-law, Edith and Joseph Daigle, in Plantation, Florida. Roselli spends most days reading by the pool, walking his poodle, and then watching television in the evenings. He never plays the same golf course twice for fear of getting murdered. On those occasions that he does make dinner reservations, Roselli always books under his sister's name. The mobster believes this caution protects him from being killed. But he is wrong. The hit team from Chicago is patient and methodical, carefully monitoring Roselli's scant activities. Upon completion of his testimony, Roselli tries to make amends with the underworld. He meets with Santo Traficante of the Tampa crime family, whom Roselli testified was heavily involved in the plot to murder Fidel Castro. As a result of that testimony, Traficante himself is subpoenaed to appear before the Church Committee. Traficante is among the most private crime bosses, and Roselli's actions have placed him in jeopardy. But all appears forgiven. Roselli and Traficante have dinner at the Landings restaurant in Fort Lauderdale in mid-June. Despite the obvious fact that dining with a crime family boss that he has betrayed could be dangerous, Roselli does not feel uncomfortable. Josie, Traficante's wife, and Roselli's sister Edith are also present. Edith will later report that it was a polite evening and no business was discussed. But on July 28, 1976, Johnny Roselli finds out what happens to those who defy the mob. After a late breakfast with his sister, Roselli borrows her year-old silver Impala. The mobster tells Edith he is going to play golf and puts his clubs in the trunk. But instead, Roselli drives to a North Miami marina. He parks the Impala and walks to the dock, where he greets an old friend. He is also introduced to a visitor from Chicago, whereupon the three men board a waiting boat for a quiet afternoon at sea. For the debt-ridden Roselli, who longs for a return to the action, this is perhaps a chance to reinsert himself into the upper levels of organized crime. If he suspects anything is amiss, he does not show it. The dinner with Santo Traficante has assured Roselli that he has made amends and his Senate testimony is forgiven. After months of caution and looking over his shoulder, Roselli steps aboard the boat and accepts the offer of a cocktail. He asks for vodka, then settles into a deck chair to enjoy the cruise. Footnote: the description of Roselli's murder on the boat was provided by an anonymous source to the New York Times. End footnote. As soon as the boat pushes off and motors toward the intracoastal waterway, a man hiding on shore steals the silver Impala and drives it to the Miami airport, where it is parked in a busy garage and abandoned. Meanwhile, Johnny Roselli is enjoying his drink and the warm sea breeze. He does not pay attention as the visitor from Chicago maneuvers around behind him. Without warning, a powerful hand is clamped over Roselli's mouth and nose. He drops the vodka and struggles to free himself, but his emphysema does not allow effective resistance. He also has arthritis of the spine, making it difficult to fight back. Johnny Roselli is dead in less than a minute. It is not enough to dump his body overboard. The mobster might bob back to the surface before the sharks can eat him. Instead, the killers tape a washcloth over Roselli's mouth to ensure he cannot breathe if he somehow comes back to life. Then his legs are sawed off. A rope is tied around Roselli's neck, and large tow hooks are inserted into his abdomen just below the ribs. The two murderers then lift the body with the rope and hooks, placing it inside a metal oil drum measuring 3 feet high and 22 inches across. Holes have been drilled into the metal so it will sink. After the torso is inside, both severed legs are shoved on top. Heavy iron chains are wrapped around the mangled corpse. Only then is the body thrown overboard. Johnny Roselli had a running joke with his brother-in-law Joe Daigle that if he ever goes missing, the best place to look for his body would be an airport parking lot. So it is that when Roselli is not home by dark, Daigle drives to the Fort Lauderdale airport in search of the silver Impala. Not finding it, he then searches the Miami airport. On the third floor of a parking garage, Daigle locates his wife's Chevy with the golf clubs inside. But no sign of Roselli. However, the world has not seen the last of him. 10 days after the mobster's murder, three fishermen spot the oil drum washed up on a sandbar in Dumfoundling Bay near North Miami Beach. Roselli's brutalized and waterlogged remains are found inside. The mobster will be cremated. And while there will be no gravesite for family to visit, the mystery of her brother's disappearance is solved for his sister Edith. But the family of another high-profile man will not be so fortunate. Jimmy Hoffa is nervous and angry. "I'm being stood up," he shouts into a payphone. It is July 30, 1975, just a month after the murder of Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli's first appearance before the church committee. Hoffa has been out of jail for 3.5 years now. Per the terms of his release, he is not allowed to hold union office until 1980, but his lawyers are working hard to get that time reduced. To keep himself busy, Hoffa has been touring the country, visiting local unions and gathering support for what he hopes to be a successful 1976 run for the Teamster presidency. But Jimmy Hoffa is well aware that the mafia has gained greater authority over the union since he was forced to step down. They control his hand-picked successor, Frank Fitzsimmons, who was never meant to be more than a caretaker until Hoffa's release. However, Fitzsimmons has proven pliant in his relations with the mob, more than willing to make Teamster pension funds available for loans and other deals to enrich the mafia. As a result, he is a most formidable opponent. Tony Provenzano is the leader of the powerful New Jersey Local 560. But Tony Pro, as he is known, also holds the rank of capo in the Genovese crime family. His enemies have a way of disappearing. Among them, Armand Cookie Fagno and Anthony Castellito, whose bodies are thought to be entombed in a 60-acre New Jersey landfill known as Brother Moscato's Dump. Footnote: it is believed by some that the dump may contain the body of Jimmy Hoffa. End footnote. Making the situation even more unpredictable, Hoffa and Provenzano knew each other while serving time in Lewisburg Penitentiary, where they were not on friendly terms. "It's because of people like you that I got into trouble in the first place," Hoffa said to Tony Pro, alluding to Bobby Kennedy's successful public unveiling of the relationship between the Teamsters and the Mafia. But today is a chance for a new beginning, though it is off to a bad start. Hoffa was due to have lunch with Provenzano and Detroit mafioso Anthony Giacalone at 2 p.m. this afternoon. Both men are late. The meal is supposed to take place at the Maucus Red Fox restaurant in Bloomfield Hills, 7 miles northwest of Detroit. Hoffa knows it well. Like Carl's Chop House, the Red Fox is a frequent Teamster hangout. Hoffa's son James held his wedding reception here. Normally, Hoffa would never bring Mafia members to this highbrow establishment, but due to the sensitive nature of today's meeting, the union leader makes an exception. This is to be a peace meeting between Hoffa and Tony Pro, an attempt to achieve reconciliation between the two men and discuss the future relationship between the mob and Teamsters if and when Jimmy Hoffa takes back his old job. Nevertheless, Jimmy Hoffa is uncomfortable. He suspects something isn't quite right. So Hoffa is not himself today. His wife Josephine will later recall how tense Hoffa looked as he left the house, as if he had a premonition of bad things happening. In fact, Hoffa is so ill at ease that en route to the lunch, he makes an impulsive visit to the limousine company owned by a good friend, Louis Linteau, hoping he might come along as an ally. But Linteau is out, and Hoffa must proceed alone. Dressed in blue pants, blue shirt, white socks, black Gucci loafers, and sunglasses, Hoffa arrives and then waits in the parking lot across from the restaurant. It is 2:15 when Hoffa phones Josephine, who tells him no one has called to explain the delay. He tells her he will be home by 4 p.m. to barbecue steaks. Hoffa hangs up, then resumes pacing. Despite the fact that he has not yet been restored to Teamster leadership, Jimmy Hoffa is popular and famous among Detroit union members. So even as he frets in the parking lot, Hoffa is approached by two local men eager to say hello and shake his hand. They leave. By 2:30, Jimmy Hoffa is still waiting for Tony Pro and Anthony Giacalone. Sometime between 2:45 and 3 p.m., Hoffa's wait comes to an end. A maroon sedan pulls up. Three men sit inside. Jimmy Hoffa steps into the vehicle, taking a seat up front on the passenger side. At the age of 62, with a lifetime on the fringe of the murky world of organized crime, Hoffa is well aware that he has chosen a perilous place to sit. It was Al Capone's rival Jaime Weiss during the days of Prohibition who invented the manner of execution known as taking a ride. The victim sits in the front seat, unable to see the actions of the man sitting directly behind him, who then shoots him in the head. Another version is for the individual in the back to loop a rope or piano wire around the neck of the person sitting in front, then strangle the victim. That scenario was used in the movie The Godfather. Jimmy Hoffa must have completely trusted the driver of the sedan, thought to be either a Lincoln or Mercury, as described by an eyewitness who saw Hoffa get in. And he must have felt at ease with the men in the back seat. Nervous, alone, and battle-hardened, Hoffa would never put himself in the hands of adversaries. As Jimmy Hoffa settles into the front seat, events unfold that still remain a mystery. Only one thing is certain. Hoffa vanishes. Footnote. The authors of this book investigated thoroughly, but could find no authoritative account to explain what happened to Jimmy Hoffa. Various scenarios have been portrayed in books and movies, but to this day, the FBI has never solved the case. On December 9, 1982, a Michigan judge declared Hoffa legally dead, despite the absence of a corpse. Charles Chucky O'Brien, a longtime friend of Hoffa, believed the union boss was killed over fears he might give testimony to the church committee. There is an allegation that O'Brien, trusted by Hoffa, actually drove the car that picked him up. Before he died on February 14, 2020, O'Brien denied any knowledge of Hoffa's disappearance. End footnote. And so it is that in 1975 and 1976, major crime figures Giancana, Roselli, and Hoffa are off the board. They will be replaced by young blood, organized crime members who are even more ruthless than their predecessors. But one of these men is not who he appears to be. His name is Donnie Brasco. Chapter 21. August 3, 1982, Federal District Court, Manhattan, New York, 10 a.m. The mob's worst nightmare takes the witness stand. It has been 6 years since FBI Special Agent Joseph D. Pistone, a.k.a. Donnie Brasco, went under deep cover to infiltrate the Bonanno crime family. Now, he prepares to testify about his life inside the mob. Agent Pistone is 43, with a confident demeanor. He wears a dark blue sports coat, light blue slacks, and a striped red tie as he takes the oath. The jury is composed of 4 men and 8 women. Across the courtroom, which is filled with 150 spectators, are men Brasco once considered brothers during his life as a mafioso: Benjamin Lefty Guns Ruggiero, John Saracini, Nicholas Santora, and Antonio Tomasulo. All are on trial for racketeering conspiracy. Special Agent Pistone is the key witness in this trial. That is evident by the fact that the mob has placed a $500,000 bounty on his head. It is the spring of 1976 when Joseph Pistone volunteers to expose the mob. He has been an FBI agent for almost 7 years with a wife and 3 daughters, living in New York City. Never before has the Bureau successfully placed an agent inside the mafia, and Pistone's chances of success in this clandestine world are slim. And yet, if ever there is an ideal candidate to pull this off, it is Joseph Pistone. The special agent grew up in Paterson, New Jersey, a street guy, in his own words, where he hung out in mob-run social halls and witnessed mafia life firsthand. "I knew how wise guys acted," he will write in his autobiography. "I knew the mentality. I knew the things to do and not to do. Keep your mouth shut at certain times. Don't get involved in things that don't concern you." Pistone brings special skills to his job. He speaks fluent Italian, born into a family of Sicilian heritage. He looks the part, powerfully built at 6 feet tall, 180 pounds, with broad shoulders, high forehead, and the tough, streetwise confidence of a man who can handle himself under pressure. On the surface, Joe Pistone easily passes as a mob foot soldier. The FBI under J. Edgar Hoover rarely used undercover agents. The director believed they might be compromised in the criminal world full of vice and money. However, Joe Pistone has already proved himself a capable operator, having just spent 2 years inside a vehicle theft ring. It is his ability to drive an 18-wheel truck that landed Pistone that assignment. But now the stakes are far higher. The special agent must convince the ferocious Bonanno crime family to trust him with secrets. A daunting task, to say the least. Before going undercover, Pistone spends months immersing himself into his persona as a small-time jewel thief named Donnie Brasco. He attends FBI gemology classes, learning about precious stones and how they are illegally bought and sold. Pistone's name and employment record are erased from all FBI files. Co-workers and even good friends are not told of his assignment. His wife and daughters are relocated to a home in a different state with a new last name and the realization that they will not see Joe for months at a time, and even then, he will only be home for a day or so. At first, the family is fine. Maggie Pistone and the girls all welcome their new circumstance. But in time, the strain of Pistone's job and the long periods of separation will lead Maggie to deeply resent her husband's job. To escape questions, his teenaged daughters tell friends their parents are divorced. He will miss all the family birthdays and graduations. Making matters even worse, Pistone is not allowed to tell his family about his assignment, leaving them completely in the dark as to why he is abandoning them for such long periods of time. The FBI gives Pistone two apartments, one in Miami and one on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He also possesses, under his new name, credit cards, social security identification, a driver's license, and a monthly stipend of spending money so he can look and act like a gangster. Joe Pistone is a driven man, but feels enormous guilt over leaving his family. In September 1976, Donnie Brasco goes into action. He is on his own, unable to make immediate contact with the Bureau if things go wrong. The agent meets once a month with an FBI official who replenishes his cash. But as far as protection is concerned, Brasco has none. The chances of taking a bullet behind the ear are very high. The undercover operation is supposed to last 6 months. Instead, it continues for 5 perilous years. "You got a beef?" Donnie Brasco asks the mobster known as Patsy. Brasco's immersion into the underworld begins by frequenting bars and restaurants known to be mob hangouts and befriending small-time gangsters. For the most part, Brasco finds it tedious. "I'd play cards, drink a little, hang around," he will remember. The agent refrains from asking too many questions to avoid suspicion. He soon becomes part of a crew of hijackers in Brooklyn, knowing that his first order of business each day is to check in with the crew boss sometime between 10 and 11 a.m. On this particular morning, Brasco's outspoken behavior and brash reputation become sources of irritation to crew boss Jilly Greca, who asks his second-in-command, a mafioso nicknamed Patsy, to see if Brasco is legitimate. "You say you pulled off all those scores down in Miami before you came here," Patsy says to Brasco, "but we don't know nothing about that. So Frankie and me want to know somebody you did those jobs with so we can check you out." "You don't need to check me out," Brasco responds. "I don't have to satisfy you just because you were in the can." "Yeah, you do," Patsy replies. "Let's go back inside and sit down." The two men walk into a clothing store on 15th Avenue, where Jilly maintains an office. Its name is ACERG, Jilly's last name spelled backward. The front section features racks of low-priced clothing procured by hijacking garment trucks and burglarizing other establishments. The back room features a desk and card tables where Jilly's crew hangs out. "When they got up in the morning, they didn't think about going to work and punching a time clock," Pistone will write. "The mob was their job. You got up, went to the club or wherever you hung out, and spent your day with those guys." Patsy pulls a loaded pistol from a drawer and places it on the desk. "You don't leave here until you give me a name." Brasco knows he cannot give in, at least for a while. His undercover status means that he actually does possess the name of a low-level informant in Miami who will vouch for the agent's criminal reputation, but passing along a name too quickly will mark Brasco as a potential snitch. So in this first dangerous confrontation, Brasco blusters. "I'm not giving up the name just to satisfy your curiosity," he tells Patsy. "You got a fucking smart mouth. You don't give me a name, the only way you leave here is in a rolled-up rug. You gotta do what you gotta do, but I ain't giving you a name." A short time later, after calculating the odds, Brasco takes a chance and gives up a name. He is then locked in a room with several other mobsters where they play cards and smoke while Patsy checks out Brasco's story. "We sat there for hours. Everybody but me was smoking. We all sat and breathed that crap. Played cards and bullshitted, Joseph Pistone will later write. He is nervous, knowing there's no way out of the room. The gun is still on the table, but the room full of mafiosi all have their own guns anyway. Finally, Patsy returns, wearing a relieved look. We got an answer, and your guy okayed you. After a year of surreptitiously recording conversations and memorizing the names and license plates of New York mafiosi, Donnie Brasco is finally introduced to the higher-ups in the Bonanno family. He quickly befriends mobsters Anthony Mira and Dominic Napolitano, who eventually trust him so thoroughly that his mob membership is a fait accompli. Brasco not only gets on the inside, but incredibly, becomes a trusted companion of Benjamin Lefty Guns Ruggiero, a rising member of the Bonanno outfit. I'm telling you now, pal, you belong to me alone, Ruggiero tells Brasco as he brings him into the family. I'll die with you. I know that, Brasco replies. Now you're affiliated officially, Ruggiero tells him, cementing Joseph Pistone as the greatest undercover agent in FBI history. But one that may perish at any time. Lefty Ruggiero is a vicious killer, known to have at least 26 confirmed murders. Brasco's initial role is to assist Ruggiero's bookmaking operation, but in time, their friendship grows so strong that Brasco dines often at the Ruggiero home in Manhattan. He counsels Lefty in dealing with the mobster's stepson, who is addicted to heroin. Footnote: Thomas Sabano, Benjamin Ruggiero's stepson, was found shot to death in the front seat of a Lincoln Continental convertible parked in a garage on the Lower East Side of Manhattan on January 15, 1984. Also dead in the car was Joseph Chile, son of a top Bonanno family capo, leading police to believe the killing was a mob hit. End footnote. Ruggiero himself is a gambling addict, and Brasco covers some of his debts. On a daily basis, Donnie Brasco's life becomes a long sequence of mafia social clubs, bars, parties, and card games. As a wise guy, you can lie, you can cheat, you can steal, you can kill people, legitimately, Ruggiero tells Brasco. You can do any goddamn thing you want, and nobody can say anything about it. Who wouldn't want to be a wise guy? Through it all, Donnie Brasco's friendship with Lefty Ruggiero grows deeper. The two men become so close that the mobster even asks the special agent to serve as best man for his 1977 wedding to his second wife, Louise. By February 1980, the connection between Brasco and Ruggiero escalates into a dangerous situation. Lefty is pushing for Brasco to become a made man inside the mob. That means Donnie Brasco would have to execute someone in service to the Bonanno family. The FBI, of course, could never sanction that. Agents are prohibited from committing acts of violence other than self-defense. The undercover operation is now in its fifth year. But problems are starting to accumulate. One March afternoon, Brasco and Ruggiero are sitting in a Miami restaurant with Lefty flipping through a copy of Time magazine. The mobster notices an unusual photograph of a yacht named Left Hand. The vessel is part of a story about the FBI and its undercover assets. Several months prior, Donnie Brasco had used that yacht to entertain a group of mafiosi and their wives in Biscayne Bay. Ruggiero was part of the outing. The killer looks up from the magazine and immediately demands an explanation. Brasco is caught by surprise, but is glib enough to say he knows nothing about any FBI involvement with the yacht. Maybe, Brasco says, he was scammed. Ruggiero is skeptical, but puts the matter aside, at least for the moment. Joseph Pistone will later write that mobsters are thieves first and not primarily an organization of murderers.